Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I am conducting an exclusive interview with Warren McFarlane, Professor Emeritus at Harvard Business School. Professor McFarlane is a world-renowned thought leader in business and in technology. Warren, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
I'm absolutely delighted to be with you.
Warren, we can learn more from your long history of successes. Can you profile how you got to your present position and what your current role entails?
It actually is, I got to my position actually by starting at the very beginning of the information systems field, and it was a course I took in computer programming in 1958 in Harvard College, which then sort of, when I got to the Harvard Business School, it turned out that I knew more than almost anybody, including the faculty, and I then spent the next 45 years on the faculty here, working continuously on one aspect or another of the field of computer technology.
What important career insights and lessons can you share from your considerable experiences as a world-renowned leader?
I think there's sort of three things that maybe particularly I think a function of the field I've been brought in. The first one is the need for continual reinvention, that almost everything that I teach today, 5 years from now, it'll be shaped and rethought in utterly different kinds of ways. I think a second critical thing is the need to surround yourselves in a network of good colleagues, both inside the school and sort of, you know, throughout the broader society. That I personally find I learn as much from my colleagues as hopefully I contribute back to them. And finally, is over time the need to really be quite adaptive and flexible. That my work over the years has taken me from the field of information technology and as opportunities came up into the field of nonprofit management and then more recently in the past decade into working with China. In each case, why the opportunity came up and it was something I thought I was interested in and was able to sort of apply my background to.
You know, that's fascinating. So what do you hope to accomplish in the next 5 years?
Well, given where I am in my career, I guess I've got sort of, you know, three major objectives. That right now, I'm launched last year a new course with one of my colleagues, Bill Kirby, the former dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, on doing business in China in the early 21st century. This is one of the three or four major initiatives at the Harvard Business School right now, and my first objective is to basically complete the development of the materials and have it safely in his hand and that of our other associates who we've been bringing onto the faculty. The second thing is that I've been working on an executive program for the last 4 years that crosses across Tsinghua University in Beijing and the Chinese European Business School in Shanghai. This has led to a whole series of new leading-edge case studies written in China, and my target is by the end of this year to have a book written in Mandarin on cases in Chinese management practice. And finally, sitting somewhat uneasily on my bookshelf, you know, is the outline for a draft of a book on nonprofit management, and that probably be another couple of years before I really get to.
So as you indicated in your answer, you're very much involved in Asia. Can you profile your vision, goals, and objectives in more detail in this region?
It's an interesting question. That the first time that I went to Asia was actually in 1979, and I spent several weeks in Malaysia, a country that I ultimately have visited probably some 25 times, you know, in the intervening years, and then went on and spent the following year, you know, 3 weeks in China. And from the moment that I first stepped into China, its sheer breadth, energy, and potential absolutely caught me between the eyes. That as I look forward, you know, for the next 30, 40 years, it's pretty clear that the dominant competitor that the United States is going to be facing in the global world markets and probably our most important diplomatic relationship will be with China. I was listening to a talk last week to John Thornton, a former managing partner, former president of Goldman Sachs, and now sitting on the board of several major Chinese and U.S. companies, as well as serving as a faculty member in Tsinghua University. And he said the basic most recent forecast he saw, which I would not challenge, is that the Chinese economy in 2040 will be about $35 trillion, that the U.S. economy will be number two in the world at about $35 trillion, India, $27 trillion, and number four, Japan, is $7 trillion. That the combination of the explosive growth of China and India simply drives this area right to the top of American business executives and the new generation of students who are coming out of the university at this particular point in time. That as I will be giving a lecture to my students another, 3 weeks or so, is that the challenges of Asia will probably be the dominant business challenges that they will be facing in their professional lifetime.
What do you see as the top trends in China, their opportunities and implications?
It's an interesting question. We talk about what the top trends are, so let me just kind of start it. But the first thing is that what catches you is that it is huge, both land-wise. It has a population of about 1.4 billion people, slightly more than 20% of the total population on the planet, and 95% of it are able to read up through the 6th to 7th grade level. Now, in those things, the first thing we notice is that they've had now 30 years of 10 to 11% growth year after year after year. The amount of growth that's going on there has now surpassed the Japanese miracle, which took place from the 50s on through to the end of the 1980s. As they are doing it, they are putting extraordinary demand on the world's energy resources, mineral resources, that my friends in Australia basically renamed themselves the Quarry of China. Almost every minute, a boat of minerals leads from China, leads from Australia, going to China. That out in Africa, the vacuum left at the end of the Cold War, when the U.S. withdrew, has been completely filled in by the Chinese working to bring all kinds of mineral oil and so forth from into their operations. Thirdly, is as a result of this incredible economic growth, has come extraordinary environmental problems. That right now, 19 of the 20 most polluted cities in the world are in China. And this stands as a dominant issue over the next decade. No different than Pittsburgh in 1950, no different than London and the killer smogs, in 1950, but again, a dominant issue for them to worry about in terms of water pollution, air pollution, the disposal of your waste, your products. Within all of this, the challenge, of course, is to sort of handle this in what will have to be sort of an evolving governmental structure. That the current political structure in China looks very, very familiar to what has gone on for the last some 4,000 or 5,000 years, where there's always been very clear centralized control from the top, and that the role that used to be filled by the emperor has now been replaced by the Communist Party at the very top, and the problems of how to evolve the governance structure there, again, is just a major challenge that will ultimately influence their ability to be completely successful.
So you've commented on this before in terms of where China's going to be relative to the U.S. and Japan in terms of, output and dollars and so forth. What do you see, or where do you see China then in 5, 10, and 20 years, and where or what are the greatest opportunities?
There are two scenarios, and let me tell you the one I hope will not be the case, and then the other one. that people today are very fond of saying that we are in the greatest age of globalization, global trade linkages in the history of the world. And that, in fact, is not true. This is actually the second greatest age. The golden age of globalism took place between 1890 and 1914, where the confluence of the steam engine, the telegraph, and the ability to link the world together for the first time and get large amounts of materials back and forth just simply drove the economies forward. And in 6 weeks, between the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand and the beginning of World War I, 6 weeks later, the entire thing, you know, fell apart. And only now have we begun in the last 25 years to really, you know, put it, you know, back together. That, of course, the danger of some cataclysmic event, you know, is always a possibility. But assuming that we're able to basically work our way through that, I think that we're going to see China basically returning to what they consider to be their rightful position as the dominant economy and increasingly developer of intellectual capital in the world. We forget that for actually most of the last 4,000 years, China dominated the Western countries in terms of the technology, medical care, you know, quality of life. In fact, you go back into, it was about 1400, was they had the largest navy fleet in the world. Their average ships, 10 times the size of that of the West. And they explored all across the Indian Ocean, you know, up the Red Sea and on into the Mideast. And then when the admiral of the fleet died, the then emperor basically went back, reloaded, decided the rest of the world actually wasn't as interesting as inside China, sort of fortified the Great Wall of China, and used that as a to worry about keeping the hordes out, which they were, of course, singularly unsuccessful, and they turned inward-looking. But that they have had a long history of technical change and so forth, and in fact, it was only in the 1840s, 1850s, that their economy began to collapse, reaching its absolute nadir in 1978. So that when I sort of you'll look at them right now, I see that they have an extraordinary opportunity to continue their position of being the major manufacturing, you know, country. But much as Germany did coming out of World War II, they are just relentlessly going right up the value chain. This is a very technologically, you know, friendly country, that they have made massive investments in communications, electronic infrastructure, and so forth to basically allow them to grow forward. It's interesting that Microsoft's most sophisticated, best research unit in the world, 500 people, is the one that they have in China. So I'm looking for them to be able to continue to grow in terms of technology sophistication, going up the value chain in terms of ever more sophisticated manufacturing products, and along the way being able to develop enough cash flow that they'll be able to turn back in and deal with many of their really intense internal problems, such as the quality of healthcare, development of housing, and things of that nature.
What do you see as the top trends globally, their opportunities and implications, and then what are the intersection points with China?
So when you talk about what the top trends are globally, we stand at a very interesting point right now, that the largest migration in human history has taken place in the last 20 years in China, as 200 million people, you know, have moved from the countryside on into the cities, and with that have basically provided the workforce that basically is producing the incredible amount of manufactured goods, you know, that they are doing. So we start with them right now as incredibly productive, that willing to work extremely long hours and in the field of manufacturing. That's number one. Number two is that we have an absolutely unsustainable balance of trade financially, where basically they're running a unsustainable trade surplus, you know, with the rest of the world. And that, of course, is a great deal, particularly the United States. And that has a great deal to do with how much longer, you know, they're going to be able to continue the rapid growth and export, you know, driven your strategy. That their savings rate is enforced by the government is somewhere over, you know, 50%. And the basic pattern is that they're getting basically significant growth in the economy, people working, you know, very hard, high savings rate, and basically we in the United States, on the other hand, are doing no savings whatsoever and are basically the consumer society, which is basically keeping the Chinese creating jobs and improving, you know, slowly their quality of life. And that's, you know, that kind of an exchange rate is just simply not going to be, you know, sustainable. And the question that stands in front of them, you know, is how they're going to be able to take the huge surpluses and drive it back in, you know, to the quality of your life. That you know, one of the things that has not been so pleasant in China is in 1978, at the tail end of the Cultural Revolution, as Deng Xiaoping started them off another direction, they had very good health care. Barefoot doctors were reaching out to the farthest corners of China. And that as this migration of people has gone inside, as they've encouraged the development of private enterprise, that large amounts of the social infrastructure, which had been supported by the former state-owned enterprises, has simply fallen apart, you know, with the result that healthcare quality has dropped dramatically, you know, over the today, over much of the country, over what it was in 1978. And those issues about how to, and at the same time, that the schools, you know, have been under tremendous pressure, and there are now 30 million more Chinese who don't read that was true back in 1978. So there's a huge change as to how they take these foreign exchange surpluses and basically find a way to invest it, you know, back into the country in a way which basically is not socially disruptive but helps drive the quality of life up.
Now, something earlier that you mentioned in the previous question was that, you know, sort of the top four nations economically, three of them will be in Asia, and you mentioned China, India, and Japan.
Japan being a tiny slice. It went from 27 trillion in India down to 7 trillion in Japan. So that the three big Asian nations really are China, India, and then you sort of then add the United States sitting on the other side of the Pacific, and those are sort of really the three big global economic powers.
So I guess then, from a broader perspective, and taking that into context, what does Asia then mean to the world?
It's an interesting your question, because right now as we stand here today, that India is playing a tremendous role now in the service economy, and that all of the growth and so forth around Bangalore, Chennai, Mumbai, and so forth, is they're having an absolutely extraordinary growth rate, and with that has been in this telecommunications world has been a huge sucking sound of a whole variety of clerical processing, programming, software jobs, and so forth have been transported into India. That India's great competitive advantage against China at this point in time is English. That Indian English is a lot different than American English, but it's a whole lot easier to understand than Mandarin. But at the same time, the Chinese are working extremely, hard on English. The premier university in the country is Tsinghua University, a university of 24,000 students in Beijing, four Nobel laureates and their alumni body. Last year, their School of Economics and Management, I think 12% of their courses were taught in English. This year, it's 62%. And it is just a driving, focus in China to, in fact, basically drive their familiarity with English in order to be able to do business, with the rest of the world. But so what you have Asia at the present moment is heavy manufacturing skills in China, heavy service skills in India. Japan, with a population barely 10% of that of China, continues to dominate for the time being on the GNP per capita. But in Japan, their challenges are that they have reached the top of a demographic bubble, and their Japanese population is now subsiding at the rate of about 1 million per year. They control immigration in a really intense way, and it's becoming a much more of a rapidly aging society at this point in time. And what this all means for the United States is that we have to engage in a really intense, kind of way, both in doing business with and finding ways of finding joint projects across all three of the countries.
You know, those are interesting figures that you give out, and I've seen another figure where they vindicated that within 10 years, the number one most populous English-speaking country in the world will actually be China. So I don't know if how accurate that figure is, but I thought it was an interesting sort of piece that's starting to get out there.
Well, it's also interesting that while that's going on, is the most popular course, in high schools right now in the language area, right behind Spanish now, is Chinese. Literally, it's every significant school in the Boston and New England area now has the first enrollment is Spanish to take care of our neighbors to the south. Number two is Chinese, and French, German, the stalwarts of the past have sort of kind of dropped into positions three, four, or worse.
Well, that kind of information will be actually of particular interest to our Chinese audience. So thank you for sharing that. There's a lot of speak of innovation in terms of it's been based in the West and historically over the longer term in China. Can you speak more specifically about innovation in Asia and in China going forward?
It's interesting because I'll start with the world of electronics and then I'll broaden it. China, unlike India, has committed for nearly 15 years, to a massive investment in telecommunications, network, fiber, and cellular infrastructure, which literally drives the length and breadth of the country. I think the current number of cell phones in the country is somewhere over 630 million and is growing at a very rapid rate. When you go and look at the engineering programs at places like Tsinghua, Fudan, and Beida, one is struck by the extraordinary technical skills that China has a very aggressive national competitive exam, which basically filters out the very best and then pours them into the leading institutions, while at the same time has grown a very broad university network across the country so that they're then developing sort of the second level of engineers, support staff, and so forth, to support the rest of the country. I mentioned, I think, earlier that Microsoft is really very clear that their very best technical center is currently located in Beijing. That a third thing is that when you walk onto an American university campus today and you look into their PhD programs, what you have been struck with is that the dominant share of Chinese and Indian students, you know, studying for their doctorates, and that to a large extent, not hard, but a very large extent, the American students have basically opted out of those very demanding kind of study programs and opted to go off and become investment bankers and so forth. Now, you snap back 10 years ago, and that graduates of those programs more or less settle down in the United States. Technical innovation, Silicon Valley, built in large amount by the innovation of the Indian Chinese. They, in fact, what has changed in the last 3 or 4 years, that as both economies are growing, a much higher percentage of people who came to be educated here are now going back home to their countries, that both India and China have reached out and tried to provide salaries, jobs, and so forth to bring the expatriates sort of, you know, back home. And so this, of course, is an enormously worrisome issue for the United States, because much of what we've done in the sciences, you know, has been immigrant labor ever since World War II. And the notion that increasing numbers of people we're educating are now leaving the country raises interesting questions about how we're going to be able to sustain some of the elements of our technology edge.
You know, you touch on this, and I've seen this recent research study indicating that there are 60,000 engineering graduates from South Korea each year, which is the same amount as the U.S., but South Korea has one-sixth the population.
Yep.
But the number of engineering graduates from China is 700,000 a year. So the prediction is that by 2010, 90% of the world's engineers and scientists and so forth will actually be in Asia.
Yeah.
And this is going to have some near-term implications and some long-term implications. So using that as a backdrop, how do you see education trending in Asia and more specifically in China? And giving your additional comparison of this with the West, and what are the implications of this long term?
Well, here it becomes you know interesting, because that the different countries there, you know have very different approaches. That all of them have highly competitive screening systems, exam systems, beginning at seventh grade, as they, in fact, you know, try and identify the best and the brightest, and then you're bringing them on up into the into the universities. That it's been a part of the Mandarinate and the professional administrator in education has been a part of Chinese culture for at least the past 1,000 years. That when Nehru took over India, that one of the things that he created was the Indian Institutes of Technology, where, again, starting in seventh grade, they basically narrowed until only the very best went forward. And similarly, in Japan, Tokyo University, and so forth. But the difference between India and China is twofold. That the first one is that in China, that the literacy down across the country is vastly greater than that of India. In India, it's barely more than 60-62% your literacy, whereas it's in the mid-90s, in China. And what that means is there's a much deeper reserve pool of trained people up through 7th, 8th grade and beyond. The third issue, which again impacts it, is that India is cursed, with the caste system, where social mobility is very, very hard. That in China, they've gone from one kind of your system under the emperors now, to the communist your party, the sons and daughters of the party leaders, you tend to get preferential admission to schools and so forth. but there's still, you know, more opportunity to move up and down, you know, inside China. None of the three countries are particularly good at handling large numbers of, you know, immigrants. That in Japan, the foreign population is like 1.5 per, you know, percent, and that, of course, is just it has caused huge problems for them now in terms of their demographics. That the competitive advantage of the states is that we've had a quite open set of borders, you know, for the intellectually, you know, gifted, and we've been able, through the combination of our space, quality of living, and so forth, to be an enormously attractive you know, magnet. But so each of them, I think, has, you know, quite different you know, problems. But that the advantage of India is the all the messiness that comes out of the democracy, voting, and things of that nature, that kind of a safety valve isn't available, you know, in China. But in return, China, if you, all you have to do is to spend, you know, 2 days in Indian China, and it'll be perfectly clear which one, you know, has the basic roads, the infrastructure, and the stuff that allows the modern economy to go forward.
Where and how do you see graduate education evolving, and why?
Graduate education in the U.S. or overseas?
Both, actually.
Well, I think I've already, you know, talked about what's been going on in the United States. That basically, our graduate programs have just enormously attractive to large numbers of the best and brightest. And, for example, at my school, because you know, English made it easier for people to come from India. I think 24 of my colleagues of our on our faculty of 240 are Indian you know, citizens who basically did their PhD somewhere in the United States, and we then and then came on here. That in there's a smaller number of the Chinese because of the language problem, and because of the language problem, they tended to be more in the analytic you know, professions, you know, science, where there's more numbers and symbolism to manipulate. But what I've noticed is I've been doing a lot of work with Tsinghua University. What great success they've had in the last few years in getting people who left China in the early to mid-80s, got their undergraduate doctorates, and went on to become young full professors in American universities, now being able to be attracted, you know, back into the homeland. Again, I notice that my Indian students now, they're looking much more enthusiastically about the opportunities, you know, to go back. Now, with that, I think that is going to lead to strengthening of the doctoral programs, you know, in India and China. But that they are still not of the same you know, caliber as the very best of what we have here. But that they are, the countries are investing, you know, in these graduate programs, and they're bringing back, it's like a vacuum cleaner. My friends at Tsinghua went out and started identifying the top 25 American universities, all the young full professors who had originally come, you know, from China, and they have been ever more successful in getting them to come back first, you know, on part-time appointments, and now increasingly on full-time appointments, as, you know, the standard of living and a whole variety of other things have become more attractive.
Earlier on in this interview, you talked about some of your key initiatives. Can you go into more detail about them and their impact?
We're doing, actually, I'll pick the China part. We've been doing some really very significant investments. Go back right to 1999. In 99, while we set up our Asian Research Center, in Hong Kong. And we put it in Hong Kong because we thought the most important country in the region that we needed to be doing research and engaging with was China. And for a variety of reasons, it was quite hard for us to get permission as an American university to put a research center in China. The second thing is that we have that center there, which makes it easier for us to do research, to write cases, and so forth. A second initiative has been the influx, of course, of significant numbers of Chinese and Indian citizens, into our MBA program here, for example. We now have probably 50 citizens of both countries scattered between the first and second year of our MBA program. Thirdly, we put in place a very special series of educational programs launched in partnership first with Tsinghua University and then ultimately with Tsinghua and CEBS in Shanghai, where the purpose was to basically, force us to go out and do the on-the-grounds materials development and, understanding of what the key issues are. Now, at the same time, those were all useful initiatives that it was, clear to me back in 1999 that somebody like myself, it wasn't going to be a good use of my time to learn how to speak Mandarin at this stage. But it was also clear that we needed to have a substantial component on our faculty, who would be willing, able to travel, work in China and be able to communicate in Cantonese and Mandarin. And so this July 1st, we now have 5 fully fluent faculty members who are totally fluent in Mandarin, and a big part of their research is in fact focusing on working across different parts of China. So we've built up executive education programs, we've developed research initiatives, we've developed field-based cases, we have brought significant number of students, and we have been able to raise money specifically to both support the research initiatives and the scholarships for the people coming from China. And all of that is what you would call an initiative that goes back in sort of the late 1990s. And it, of course, it delivered a profoundly different group of people here than what we had before.
Warren, you've written about IT governance and sort of the impact in terms of board of directors, and perhaps there should be some kinds of representation depending on the company or the industry. Where do you see this going, and why?
It's a wonderful shift in terms of what we've been talking about earlier. That we've moved into something today which is sort of an almost completely IT-enabled, facilitated kind of society, and with this, why our governance mechanisms, haven't kept up as well as they should. That courtesy of the problems of Enron, WorldCom, and so forth, that led to Sarbanes-Oxley, and it led, for example, on corporate boards to really the absolutely preeminent role of the audit committee in terms of all of the controls, checks, and balances. Now, all of that is it's important. Probably the pendulum swung a little too far, and we're working our way back towards a more middle ground. But while all that was going on, that we have not paid as much attention as we should have to the deep disruptive impacts of technologies and how they can fundamentally shape the very competitiveness of the organization. I was reading a sad note in yesterday's paper where 80% of the employees of Eastman Kodak have disappeared over the past 10 to 15 years, as the entire manufacturing base of what they deliver and how they deliver it has turned inside out. And that when I'm talking about IT governance, it's in the broadest way, it's for those organizations which really are at risk in terms of new technologies, particularly the ones on the IT side, being able to focus on this right at the top of the organization and get the research, get the innovation, make the experimental, you know, kinds of things. It's interesting that a company like Procter & Gamble, you know, this is a wonderful example, that to basically sort of make sure they don't drown in sort of internal wisdom, they have a fascinating technology committee, which is actually chaired by Scott Cook. And Scott Cook, good HBS graduate, founder of Intuit, now sitting on the board of eBay and so forth, that he is there at the center of P&G to help goad and push from the top, you know, a mindset on where these new technologies can really impact, you know, all parts of the organization's operations. So that there are some firms that aren't as well and deeply impacted by this, and therefore their governance processes are quite different. But that the paper that Dick Noller and I wrote, you know, 2 years ago in the Harvard Business Review, really was designed to kind of tease this phenomena up and talk about how that for the Procter & Gambles and the Mellon Banks and Home Depots and so forth, that they were so much at a function of the changing technologies that it had to be put into their governance process. That this work, oddly enough, is related a lot to the work of my colleague Clay Christensen, who wrote this spectacular book in 97 called The Innovator's Dilemma, you know, Why Great Companies Fail. And that what he basically made the point right at the core is that you are so comfortable with your existing customers and your own technologies that you may miss the discontinuous orthogonal disruptive technologies that can come in from the outside, start peeling away maybe your less sophisticated, less demanding customers with a better cost-value proposition, and then climb, you know, right up inside you. And that's really what's sort of got Dick Noller and myself thinking about, that that IT is one of the great disruptive technologies, and for a number of organizations, it really wasn't being seen for the strategic transforming device that it was, and its ability to actually hollow out the entire center of the company.
How do you see the technology landscape building globally, and why does this matter?
It's of course, everything is absolutely, you know, utterly, you know, interconnected. I mean, Tom Friedman, the world is flat. You can talk about a lot of things that might be wrong with this book, but the reality is that we are in a completely interlinked, you know, networked, you know, world, and with that, basically, skill bases, functions, and so forth, you know, can be re-put, you know, all around, you know, the world. But I'm a director of a large services company, and that we have maybe 90,000 employees today. We're now up to something like 17,000 in India, and that would be like from zero, you know, 7 years ago. And that we're basically taking advantage of the networks, the skill bases, to basically do the job in the most cost-effective way on the globe. And if we didn't do it, we wouldn't get much business, because our customers basically in the competitive world we live in, have a notion in their mind as to what they're willing to pay for, you know, certain you know, kinds of things. So it matters, this global technology landscape matters enormously, because you have to ask the hard questions. You know, what are the sustainable value adds that are being, you know, produced by your firm? Are they able to endure with your staff, you know, in your place at this time, you know, forever? If it's a restaurant, the answer is that's an intrinsically local business. If it's a textile company, why that that the combination of labor costs, cheap shipping, and air shipping transportation has just absolutely whittled away the ability for many of them to survive. I was working 5-6 years ago for a very large textile company in South Carolina, which just shut their last mill before Christmas. I mean, they were absolutely in this network world, unable to come up with a value-added proposition that allowed them to compete with overseas competitors.
Now, what are the hottest technology trends, and what does this mean to us?
That's always interesting. That right now, of course, that everything is focused on sort of Internet 2. That we're now in this element of social networking, Facebook, complete global interconnectedness all over mobile phones, and as you move continuously in touch and in a video networked way, wherever you go. It's I sort of watch with fascination my 34-year-old daughter who, between LinkedIn, Facebook, and her BlackBerry, it doesn't really actually matter where she is. I mean, she sort of just basically communicates literally around the globe, and her physical position, in a real sense, doesn't matter the way it used to be, and that we're just beginning to get the full potential, out of this, kind of stuff. And of course, with it, comes, huge problems of privacy, reliability, security. But, those are all sort of delimiters, rather than things which say that we aren't going to continue to go into this direction.
I do these interviews with many global leaders. I hear things like aligning IT with business needs, driving business agility, managing risk through improved governance, closing the skills gap and meeting the future skills shortage, addressing the productivity gap, improving ICT adoption rates, integrating this huge mass called Gen Y or the millennials, and more. With your insights and your deep history of successes, can you share your views on what you think are the top challenges facing business, industry, government, and education in 2008 and beyond?
I think that it starts with the trite but accurate observation that the pace of change has never been faster, that the half-life of knowledge, shorter, and all of this is playing out, on a global basis. And it puts in tremendous pressure on you, to first come back and ask, what is it that I do that is fundamentally value-added, local in nature? And what is it that is, in fact, global? And if I get even inefficient enough, what is local may become global. For example, that you look at hospital medical care. That one important part of that, of course, is that radiology interpretation, so forth, second opinions, are almost all was done on the other side of the globe today. For operations which can be scheduled, that the breakdown of the Canadian and the UK healthcare systems has created a huge opportunity for heart operations and so on and so forth to take place in India, where basically you can, that even after you factored in the cost to travel to and from, you have the same physicians that you could have in the UK and Canada, you get the thing done a lot faster, and you get it done more economically. And that to think that we don't live in a fast-changing, global, technology-mediated environment is to simply deny the world that we live in. That the question is sort of understanding what are your core advantages, what are your core competences, and how can you continue, to fresh and keep them, in your location. For this Harvard University, and I'll take particularly the business school, that we have always been under attack, and we are under even more intense attack today. It would be very easy, you know, for the skill and innovation base to disappear away. Your reputation would drop, and all of a sudden the students wouldn't be there anymore, and you'd be at Stonehenge on the Charles. So we live in and I'm here and in my other part of my life where I've been a senior associate dean here for the last 15 years, on the notion of intensely worrying about the new opportunities and then basically doing intense focused research and recruiting the best skills on it has been the key to how we're going to survive.
Do you have any additional items to add looking into the future and steps to address the various challenges? And on top of that, do you have sort of some closing comments and thoughts?
It's an interesting time because, having, talked about, all of the technologies, the globalization and so forth, you then, flip over, onto the other side and, what is the number one advantage that the United States, has? And it is, for all of its imperfections, the type of government give and take, the ability and environment which basically encourages, innovation, that we talk about the barriers, but the elevators between the top and bottom still run better, and I think that's than most of the rest of the world. And I think that's that to me it's that we've talked a lot about globalization and we've talked a lot about technology, but in the end it's the political climate, it's the government, it's the ability to embrace risk taking and change. That's what's so far has been able to keep us up and running, and that's why we continue to be such an attractive destination for people from other kinds of environments. So that there is a reason for the other parts of the university in terms of all of the what I'll call the social science and the political things. And obviously in China this is a problem that they will be working with over probably the next three generations. I mean, these things, they are not easily taken care of. That the implicit, when I was talking about the political system, is that all of the legal structure and the legal, environment. I mean, you go back and you look at where our trust busters and why the FDA was put together and the Securities Exchange Commission in the early parts of the 20th century, those all came out of, massive, excesses, quality of food, misrepresentation of financial markets, and, we've somehow been able to adapt those mechanisms, while keeping the give and take in the political process working. And I think that's I think that remains one of our great sources of advantage as long as we continue to be hungry, competitive, and so forth.
Well, Warren, I want to really thank you for taking the time to share your valued and accumulated wisdom and deep insights with the audience. You are a historical contributor to the world and have been and will continue to be, and we will continue to follow your innovative work and global leadership with keen interest. So thank you.